You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining us today is John Wilsey, professor of church history at Southern Seminary, also serving as the William Simon Visiting Fellow in Religion and Public Life at Princeton, where he lives with his wife Mandy and his two daughters Carolyn and Sally, and attends Stonehill Church there. Dr. Wilsey is currently working on a book on John Foster Dulles. He also has books on American exceptionalism and Christian America. That's not what we're talking about right now. Right now, we're talking about Alexis de Tocqueville. Dr. Wilsey has an abridgment of Democracy in America published with Lexham Press. He's also currently working on a guide to democracy in America on the Acton blog, a biweekly guide. So Alexis de Tocqueville, right, famously comes to America to study prisons. And I've got to ask, did he ever write his book on prisons? And is it, if he did, is it worth reading?
They did. They did write their book on prisons. It came out, I can't remember exactly what year it came out, but it did come out before Volume 1 of Democracy in America came out, which came out in 1835. And it was co-authored by both Tocqueville and Beaumont. As I recall, Beaumont was the one that did most of the legwork on the writing of it.
Tocqueville was busy.
Yeah, Tocqueville was working on Volume 1 of Democracy, very, very hard at work with that. And when it came out, it won a very prestigious award, which came with a cash prize, actually. And they were able to pay off their outstanding debts from their trip to America because even though the Ministry of Interior commissioned them and sponsored their trip, the French government did not give them any funding for it. So they relied on Tocqueville's family money. And then the cash prize that they won for the book on the prisons helped to alleviate any further debts that they had incurred. The book is on the penitentiary system, or I think it's called On the Penitentiary System in America. I've actually not read that book, and it's not in print anymore. And I don't know that it's even available any longer. It's don't know that it was ever translated into English. But at the time in the 1830s, it was, it was very well received, you know, and it sort of established Tocqueville and Beaumont's reputation in that particular field.
So we don't have to say his trip here was a failure.
Not at all. It was a blazing success, much, much more successful than either one of them probably could have ever imagined.
And is there, I guess, by way of introduction, is there anything else we need to know about Tocqueville's background before we dive into the text?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tocqueville is a really interesting figure. He's very young when he goes to America. He's about 27 years old when he goes to America, or 26 years old, actually, when he goes to America. And Beaumont, his travel companion there, he's also quite young. They were both young lawyers. They met in law school. They traveled to America between May of 1831 and February of 1832. So right in the middle of what's known as the Jacksonian period in American history. Tocqueville's family were members of the minor aristocracy. They owned property, they owned land, and very ancient family. To trace their family roots all the way back to the Battle of Hastings, 1066, the Norman conquest of England. And Tocqueville's family suffered greatly during the Revolution of 1789. He had a grandfather on his mother's side that was executed at the guillotine. His aunt was executed at the guillotine. His parents were imprisoned and awaiting execution. And the only thing that saved him was the fall of Robespierre, in 1793, and shortly after Robespierre's death, they're freed from prison. So his family's experiences in the Revolution of 1789, he sort of lives in the shadow of those experiences as a child and as a young man growing up, as a teenager growing up. And, his perspective on revolution is very different than Americans' perspective on revolution. And one of the things he's interested in is, how is it that Americans could have had a revolution that resulted in political and social stability? Because that was not the French experience at all. So those are some things to kind of set the table for us as we think about Tocqueville's perspective when he comes to America and observes what he says is the development of equality of conditions in a way that he had never seen, of course, in feudal France.
Yeah, I want to get back to the equality of condition bit, but certainly Tocqueville's view of the American Revolution, I think, is interesting because he, I'm trying to think of a good way to say this, he equates the American Revolution and the French Revolution in a way that I think would have horrified someone like Edmund Burke, right, who was very careful to draw a distinction between the two events from a sort of a Burkean perspective. You can't compare the two the way that Tocqueville does because they're so different, right? And I guess I'm not entirely sure if that's being fair to Tocqueville. Am I reading too much Burke into the entire situation, or is that sort of a fair analysis that, no, in his mind, there the events are the same, it's just the cultural segments different?
No, I think that's right. I mean, obviously, I think that's it's really interesting that you bring Burke into it. John Stuart Mill is a huge admirer of Democracy in America, Volume One, and he thinks of course it's a masterpiece. So that's another sort of different English perspective on Democracy in America. But no, I think you're right to point that out. The revolution in America being quite different than the one in France. But I think for Tocqueville, his point is that both the big similarity that he sees is that both the American Revolution and the French Revolution are the most recent historical manifestations of the growth of equality of conditions. And certainly very broadly speaking, you can probably agree with that. Equality of right. conditions that he, of course, in his introduction is going to trace all the way back to the 11th, 12th centuries and following it all the way to his own day. Equality of condition being a providential reality, like a divine project, if you will. And in America, equality of condition has reached a point of development more advanced than anywhere in the world, anywhere, certainly in Europe. But that reality is going to take hold in Europe as well, eventually and inevitably. It's just that in America, it has reached a point of advancement far beyond anything in Europe, particularly in France.
Yeah, and it sort of naturally exists in America, right? Whereas they're trying to force it, at least in France. In Simon Chama's History of the French Revolution, he ends with I forget which. Some revolutionary figure that somehow managed to survive and escape to America, and then writes about how when he lands in New Hampshire or Vermont or somewhere like that and settles in among the people, he's like, this is what we were trying to do, and the Americans just have it. They don't even have to work for it. And we worked for it, and all we got was bloodshed. And there is something to that, which I suppose we should define the term. Tocqueville's introduction, of course, is all about equality of condition. What does he mean by that?
Well, he famously says in the second paragraph, the more I advanced in the study of American society, the more I perceived that this equality of condition is the fundamental fact from which all others seem to be derived and the central point at which all my observations constantly terminated. So one of the things, like in my blog series for Acton, in the second part, try to talk about equality of condition a little bit and what it means. When we use the term equality, we are sort of used to a particular contemporary understanding of it in modern times. We think about it as Americans in the 21st century, perhaps as something like equal rights and equality of rights in sort of rights discourse. Rights would be a context for the way we understand equality, but that's not really the way that Tocqueville is defining equality of condition. The way he defines equality of condition is very broad, taking into consideration social, economic, political, military, religious equality, where you have a leveling off of a feudal caste system that, of course, he's sort of accustomed to in France. The rising up of people, who would be considered lower class up into the middle class, and then conversely, the bringing down of what might be considered aristocracy. So a social, an economic, military, political, and religious leveling off of the population, occurring because of a lot of different historical realities, like the Protestant Reformation, the rise of the middle class, starting in the 13th century, leveling off of the ecclesial caste system that Tocqueville says begins in France in the 12th century, the discovery of America, which is going to have a very leveling effect on the populations of England, Spain, and France, the early colonizers in those days. Also the availability of education in particularly in New England. These are all realities that sort of contribute to equality of condition, this leveling off of society. And there's another thing that he means by equality of condition, and that is in America, in the American context, and that is mobility, not just social mobility or economic mobility, but certainly physical mobility. He says that Americans are always in motion, always moving around. And so, as you remember, the feudal order ties you to the land. Everybody is tied to the land in the feudal system, from serfs all the way up to the king, because land in the feudal system is really the measure of wealth and the standard of wealth. But with the rise of the middle class, wealth becomes measured on a cash basis, right? So by the time you get to America, there's so much land available from the perspective of white settlers, that is, that Americans are constantly moving west, and Americans are constantly looking for opportunities to better their fortunes as they move west. This is equality of condition is a huge dynamic that he talks about. It's not just equal rights. It's not just he doesn't use that language. He means something much more broad, and equality of condition is sort of the pivot or the fulcrum, if you will, that the entire two-volume work of Democracy in America sort of rests upon and shifts on, and all his discussions sort of have equality of condition there in the background.
Which is interesting, because he's not necessarily friendly to it, right? I mean, it's...
Exactly. I mean, he is an aristocrat. His title, Tocqueville, I mean, it's not his family name, it's his title. So he is a member of the French aristocracy, and he's as he reflects on equality of condition, he thinks that it's a providential certainty. He thinks that this is a divine project, and he doesn't think there's anything anybody can do to stop it. And there's a lot of things about it that he likes. And he's very fascinated by it, but he sees himself as an aristocrat, and he enjoys aristocratic privilege, particularly when, he pursues a political career back in France after he gets back from America in 1832. So he also thinks that equality of condition is a threat to liberty in many ways. And he thinks that Americans have been effective at checking the influence of or the growth of despotism in a democratic society. But he does believe that equality does tend towards despotism. And so he's very cautious about the democratic project in that regard.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that, That's interesting. The idea of democracy leading to tyranny is not something that most Americans are really capable of thinking of. Capable is maybe not quite the right way to say that, but given our current equality of condition, maybe it is the right way to say it. We're no longer capable of thinking, hey, maybe it's bad that we're all equal. Maybe it's destructive to liberty.
That's right. That's right.
You've mentioned aristocracy a few times. So in his introduction, he compares and contrasts aristocracy and democracy. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So like in the introduction, he gives a are you talking about like the development of equality of conditions historically? Is that what you're referring to? Or?
He sort of compares and contrasts them at their best, I guess, kind of the idealized democracy.
That's right. Yeah. And so, with aristocracy, the things that he likes about aristocracy is that aristocracy forms sort of a formal relationship between the nobility and, you know, the population, so that where there are local problems, the aristocracy steps in to help to address those problems on a local level. But there's no aristocracy in America, not at least not a feudal aristocracy like they're, you know, like he's accustomed to in France. So for the Americans spontaneously step in through mediating institutions, voluntary organizations, voluntary societies to deal with and address problems on a local level. So if a road, for example, is in disrepair, it'll be citizens that come together in what he calls a public spirit in New England, maybe through a voluntary society that is dedicated specifically to fixing the road. And they'll handle that in a spontaneous manner. Whereas in an aristocracy, it's the local aristocratic structure that would take care of those sort of things. So in America, he thinks it's more efficient and it's faster and it has a longer lasting positive effect because the people have a vested interest in, for example, the maintenance of the road. Because not only am I, for example, going to enjoy a smooth road, so are all my neighbors. So I have a vested interest in a good road, just as my neighbors do. So this is one of the aspects of how he compares and contrasts aristocracy, voluntary organizations, voluntary societies, mediating institutions, however you want to define it. He thinks that those are sort of maintained by the mores in America that foster and that guard liberty and also, you know, the spread of religion and Christian morals in America. And so that is going to be, in an aristocracy, those are going to be formally institutionalized through the church and through the established religion. And he's amazed by, for example, with freedom of religion, there's no state church, but people, Americans are more religious than they are in France. So those are a couple of things that he looks to contrast the two.
Yeah, I don't remember the dates exactly, but I think he's passing through right as the last state churches are going away. I think that state church in Massachusetts goes away about the time Tocqueville goes through. I don't remember exact years there.
Yeah, they get rid of theirs in 1833. So it's Massachusetts still has a state church, but I believe Connecticut state church, it's disestablished in the 1820s. I want to say 24, but I'm not sure. But Connecticut is disestablished, but Massachusetts is not yet when he goes through.
Right. So he's seeing that process as he's going through. If it's something he even notices, I assume some of that was done quietly. But, Well, maybe we should jump into the text itself. The introduction is endlessly fascinating. Tocqueville opens with a discussion of American history. What makes America unique in terms of our history? What does our history bring to the discipline of political science? Maybe is a way to ask that.
Yeah, I mean, he later in volume two, in book one of volume two, he uses the term exceptional to sort of characterize Americans. Of course, this is way down the road from where we are right now. But when he uses the term exceptional, he's struck by the power of geography on American history and on the American identity. And his first chapter, as a matter of fact, it's called The Exterior Form of North America. So he starts off the book with a discussion of American geography. He sort of falls into line with the attitudes of the day of the early 19th century that Providence had reserved the American continent and North America for the development of a civilization that would occur after the Protestant Reformation. He does believe that God sort of reserves America for the development of this civilization that's going to advance equality of condition in a more efficient and in a more comprehensive way. He thinks that because of American geography, because of the frontier, for example, it shapes the American identity and American character in a very unique way. Sort of, Tocqueville sort of writing in the 1830s is in many ways anticipating the Turner thesis, that is that the frontier is what shapes American identity. Frederick Jackson Turner writes that article delivered a paper in 1893, Significance of the Frontier in American History, where he sets out that thesis. But when you read Tocqueville, it really is interesting because he sort of anticipates that thesis that's going to come many decades later. He thinks that the Puritans of New England are they're the ones that capture the American mindset more perfectly than any other group that settles in the American colonies through their religion, through their what he calls public spirit, through voluntary associations, through being able to achieve liberty in the face of equality of condition. I think those are some really interesting details that he brings out, sort of distinguishing Americans from Englishmen. Of course, they are English speaking, and they are cousins of the English, the English nation. But Americans aren't really interested in philosophical inquiry like Europeans are. They're more interested in pragmatics. They're more interested in utilitarian considerations. They're more interested in pursuing wealth. Of course, they're much more interested in movement. They're not tied to the land like Europeans are. So he underscores those very distinct elements in the American mindset, American character. And another maybe person that's interesting to read Tocqueville alongside of is Hector St. John de Crèvecœur, who writes Letters from an American Farmer, roughly the same time period, a little bit earlier. It's 18th century work, but Crèvecœur is another Frenchman that comes to America. He comes to America in the 18th century. He serves in the French and Indian War for the French. He's mustered out of service. He's given a dishonorable discharge, as it were, and he settles in Pennsylvania, and he writes Letters from an American Farmer, which are, some really reflections on what life is like as an English subject. And his writings sort of evolve from the 1760s into the 1770s during the Revolutionary time period. And he sees the impact of the American Revolution out in the backcountry, and he writes about it. He experiences it firsthand, and he writes about it. So Crèvecœur is sort of an interesting person to read alongside Tocqueville to sort of get another French perspective on American history and American identity 18th century and the early 19th.
Right, and there's obviously the unique characteristic of America that you can see all of our history, right, and trace our development in a way that you really can't with most European countries. Right, with European nations, you run into that Dark Ages, or Middle Ages, or however you want to say that, where who knows what's going on and who knows where these institutions are coming from. And by the time you get really good records, everything just sort of is there. In America, for the most part, we can kind of trace everything and we can draw conclusions about it, and we can maybe extrapolate a little bit out of it and start talking about the nature of democracy in America in a way that you can never really talk about democracy in England, because it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, because I mean, England's traditional political ideas and structure and constitution, there a lot of it is unwritten and a lot of it is traditional, and it goes back, of course, many centuries before, you know, our history begins. Of course, medievalists who might be listening in would really hate it that we might use the word Dark Ages. But
yes, but yeah, that's why I used it.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's like it's really interesting. I mean, when you think about, you know, origins, national origins, the French and the English I'm thinking of in particular, of course, all of them do. But everybody has origin myths and theirs are very distinctive. And of course, the origin of the French nation going all the way back to the fall of the Roman Empire. I mean, and the rise of the Frankish kingdoms. I mean, that history is all extremely interesting and very complex. And I think because it's so old, it goes back so far, and because it is so complex, and because it also involves a lot of different people groups who merge and form these nations that we're accustomed to calling England and France and so forth. For Americans, it's so far back, it's so old, and we're accustomed to our history having a much more concrete and specific beginning. But sort of the same sort of thing applies to us. I mean, if we think about our origins, our historical origins rather than our mythical origins, we also have a lot of complexity in the way America is comes to be as a nation, First Nations and white colonization and white settlers' contact with First Nations, and also of course slavery and the bringing of African Americans over from America. We Americans, you know, in our master narrative, if you will, we know that blacks, of course, are brought over from Africa. But one thing that a lot of times gets lost in that history is the national identities that the Africans brought with them over to America. They get sort of watered down into this African identity, right? But there's there are scores of tribal and national and linguistic identities that come over from Africa who are enslaved, and so these all have to relate to one another, and they all merge together in different ways, and then they also maintain their identities. In many instances, these identities are preserved despite the fact that warfare and slavery and assimilation attempt to bring those into like a melting pot, but many of those identities are maintained. So when we think about origins, it is very complex, and we have to sort of separate the mythic origins from the historic origins, and that can be a challenge.
And I don't want to get too far ahead of your blog series here, if we can avoid it, just because I think it's worth sending our listeners over to that. But I do want to talk a little bit about Tocqueville on the lack of American intellectuals, which it's not the first thing he talks about in the book, but it's towards the beginning, and then it's sort of a repeated theme as we go on through. Why are Americans so bad at thinking, according to Alexis de Tocqueville?
That's a great way to ask it. You know, it's one of those things that's really interesting when you look at just early 18th century, cultural commentary on America, not just from Tocqueville. I mean, Tocqueville recognizes this early on. But, you know, his observations that come forth in Democracy in America, those are sort of taken on, and they're seen and they're agreed with by other commentators in the early 19th century. One person I'm thinking of is John L. O'Sullivan, who is the person who was famous for coining the term Manifest Destiny in 1845. He was the editor of a pretty widely read Democratic journal called the United States Magazine and Democratic Review. And O'Sullivan writes a review, an extended review of Democracy in America, Volume 1, when it came out in 1835. And he latches on in his review of the book in the journal on, you know, Tocqueville's observation that Americans are not a literary people. They don't have, a distinct body of literature or philosophy like that's distinguished from, you know, from the British tradition. Right. And in the early 19th century, especially for someone like O'Sullivan, a literary tradition is a key component of a national identity. So Tocqueville observes this about Americans, that they don't have a strong literary or philosophic tradition that is distinctly their own. And Americans take that and say, see, this is a problem because we're trying to forge a national identity, and you can't forge a national identity without a literary and a philosophical tradition that is distinctly your own. I'm glad you brought that up because it's a really interesting observation that Tocqueville makes. But what's really interesting to me personally is how that's developed and how that's sort of latched onto by American nationalists, if you want to say imperialists of the early 19th century, leading up to, you know, the War of Conquest against Mexico in 1846. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how Americans are trying to forge a national identity that's distinctly their own, that doesn't just come out of wars with Britain or war with France or even wars of conquest, but that is a national identity that's forged and seen in a literary tradition. And it's beginning. I mean, obviously, it's starting up in the early 19th century with someone like Herman Melville or Nathaniel Hawthorne, people like that. But it's in its infancy at that time and in that period of time. Charles Dickens makes the same observation when he comes to America in the 1840s, and he sees not much of a literary tradition that's distinctly their own. But when he comes back in the 1860s. He sees that that's changed, that Americans are have a much more mature national identity in the 1860s after the Civil War. And he credits a lot of that with a literary tradition.
I guess I would want to maybe split the literary and the philosophical just a little bit, partially to defend my agreement with Tocqueville that democracy makes you stupid. What's compelling to me is what's going on in European philosophy in, you know, early 19th century, Kant, Hegel, the whole sort of German idealist movement, similar things going on in English philosophy, right, with Mill and other utilitarian writers. And in America, we certainly have brilliant people, right? The founding generation, I think, has more than its share of brilliant people. But all of them, by their own admission, and own a very vociferous admission, is that they are not philosophers. They're practical thinkers, right? They're putting together a workable government. They're not coming up with a theory of government, even if there's a theory of government involved. And I don't want to say there's a stream of anti-intellectualism at that point, because I don't think there is. But what it seems that Tocqueville is doing is tying this lack of intellectuals to equality of condition, and saying that the one is caused by the other, right? We don't have intellectuals because we pull people who would be smarter down to the level of the herd.
Yes. Okay. I get what you're going with there. Yeah.
Well, I hadn't thought of your point of that being tied to imperialism and tied to certainly the literary movement, you know, with Washington Irving, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and, you know, sort of consciously trying to forge a body of thought. But just on the philosophical side, you know, I love me some Emerson. He's not Hegel, right? I like a lot of the American writers that I've read, particularly from the 19th century, but they're not the equivalent of the Europeans. It just seems that there is something to that argument that democracy does not lead to the conditions where people who should be individually fostered into intellectual giants can be. And I think, is it Nathan Hatch who has the book on the effects of that on Christianity too? You know, why don't we have great theologians, right? Well, it's again, we don't tolerate that. We can all read the Bible for ourselves. We don't need some egghead from, you know, some egghead from Princeton telling us what to think about our Bibles.
Yeah. And not only him, but then also Mark Knowles' Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, I think, you know, asked the same question, really.
Yeah. Which he's recently tried to roll that back a little bit. And I'm a little disappointed with him for caving, but he
might have, but others who have, you know, really sunk their teeth into that thesis have continued to advance it, especially since the election of Trump, which we won't talk about, right? Because that's a whole nother.
Hey, it's appropriate. The story is that Trump has moved the portrait of Andrew Jackson into the Oval Office. So there is a Tocqueville connect, right? Tocqueville was in America during 19th century Trump's time in the Oval Office. So in the White House. Man, he's only been president for 6 months. Is that right?
Yeah, 6 months.
It feels like years and years and years.
It does feel a lot longer. It really does.
So we can't really compare him with Jackson at this point, but those will be interesting comparisons down the road, I think.
You know, and there's a lot of conversation about that, about, you know, what are the similarities, what are the differences? In fact, I saw an article come out by Miles Smith, and I think it was in Gospel Coalition. It was just this week or last week, addressing that very question. And he did a good job of sort of saying, here are the similarities and differences between Trump and Jackson. But again, that might be another conversation for another day.
Right. Well, Jackson has actually shot people on Fifth Street. Trump has only said he could. So
he's only talked about it. Right. And Jackson was actually a convert to Christianity. And right. Trump cannot be described in that way.
Well, one last question before we take up too much of your time. You've talked a little bit about slavery, and I think that's a good, I don't know if it's a good point to end, but it is a point to end an initial dip into Tocqueville, because he ties slavery together with aristocracy. You know, he points out that America doesn't have aristocrats in the formal European sense, but we do have slaves, and that also affects us, right? That particularly in the South, course. What are we supposed to do with that kind of parallel? Is he onto something there? Has he missed something? Have I misread him? Aristocracy, slavery, democracy, how do they all fit together in Tocqueville?
You know, Tocqueville makes a big deal out of how aristocracy does not exist in America. This one little footnote in volume two, book three, chapter 18, he says, I speak here of the Americans inhabiting I speak here of the Americans inhabiting those states where slavery does not exist. They alone can be said to present a complete picture of democratic society. That's a really, I mean, it's a short little footnote that he has, but it speaks volumes. I mean, when he's talking about equality of condition, he's talking about the absence of feudal hierarchy, the absence of aristocracy, you know, like that, you know, it existed in France for a really long time. And Americans don't have aristocratic title, right? I mean, even the title of nobility clause is in the Constitution. Article 1, Section 9, the title of nobility clause is found. So there's no formal feudal concept of, you know, title or one's betters, but at the same time, and Tocqueville makes a lot of that, stresses that about his observations of America. But at the same time, he says that that's only really true in the North. You really can't say that. You really can't use that as a description in the South where slavery exists. In the South, you have a de facto aristocracy in place, even though you don't have a du jour aristocracy in place because of slavery. And so, in chapter 18 of volume 1, he talks about being on the Ohio River and seeing, on one side, on one bank of the Ohio, you see all his industry and all his mobility, and everybody is, everybody is increasing in wealth. And he's, of course, talking about the Indiana and Illinois side, and then cross river in Kentucky, where slavery exists. There is indolence, and you have this huge gulf between the slaves and their masters. And both the slaves and the masters are degraded by slavery. The masters are lazy. They're sitting around under the shade trees. They're not doing any labor themselves. The slaves are doing all the work, but they're not being rewarded for the fruits of their labor. Those fruits are being enjoyed by the slave owners. So degradation is, thorough and comprehensive in Southern society because of slavery and because of this de facto aristocracy and this inequality that exists on a very fundamental level in the South. It's interesting that little footnote that he puts in that place in the chapter of honor in the United States is the chapter. Democracy is something that the good kind of democracy, that is, the kind that preserving of liberty. That is, in its purest form, at least in Tocqueville's mind, is found in New England. But that, he doesn't see that translated, on a one-to-one basis down south where slavery predominates.
Right. And he notes that that's heading towards a crash, right? There's going to be a catastrophe as a result of this institution.
That's right. That's right. And he talks about that in chapter 18 of volume 1. And in that chapter, he talks about slavery as being a big problem, but he does see that slavery is on its way out. He thinks that slavery will be abolished eventually. But what will remain is race prejudice. One of the things he's really stunned by is how, racial prejudice starts at birth and goes all the way beyond the grave. I mean, black people are not buried in the same cemeteries as white people are. And he's stunned and shocked by this. And he thinks that the only way that, race prejudice can be addressed in American society is through a race war. And he's writing, of course, in 1831. Well, it's published in 1835, and that assessment will in many ways come true in the Civil War, 25 years later. So,
now we've been talking about Tocqueville for 45 minutes, and not once mentioned the phrase tyranny of the majority. So we probably shouldn't close without something about that. What is the tyranny of the majority, and is it something we should be concerned about?
Yeah, I mean, tyranny of the majority or democratic despotism, something else he calls it. I mean, he thinks that this is where equality conditions tends towards. And I think that he thinks this because of what he observes in France during his during the Revolution of 1789, and then, of course, during his own lifetime and his experiences with the Revolution of 1830, the July Revolution, that equality of condition tends towards democratic despotism or a tyranny of the majority, whereby you have a progression from public spirit, public virtue, to individualism and materialism. And by that, he's talking about how, the tendency is toward where people withdraw from civic life, and they cede their freedom and their power to a centralized government that in turn will take over where mediating institutions and voluntary societies leave off. It's too much work to be constantly involved in, you know, the betterment of your local township. And so it's a lot easier to entrust someone who will do those, take those duties on for you through the using the levers of government and the levers of a federal government, you know, more strictly speaking. What drives that tendency is for Tocqueville. One of the things that drives that tendency is when the mores of the people, the manners of the people, depending on which translation you use, shift from that public spirit that he sees in New England, where everybody has a vested interest in the betterment of the community. Or also the what he calls the interest rightly understood, where as Wilfred MacLay talks about this in his writings, he talks about how vice is put to virtue's service, where selfish interests, you know, my self interests take on they're also the interests of everybody in my community. So I'm going to pursue self interest, right? But I'm going to do it in a way that's going to benefit the entire community. That's a key aspect of a public spirit and of mores or manners, as Tocqueville sees in New England. But when those mores begin to shift to becoming more interested in pursuing wealth, more interested in selfish interests, and an inward turn to the individual, and a sort of a privatization of American society, then that's going to lead to a tyranny of the majority or to democratic despotism, where you have the job of mediating institutions is given over to a centralized government. And he writes a lot about this, and he writes a lot about it in both volumes, Volume 1 and Volume 2, thinking particularly of Chapter 17 in Volume 1 and several chapters in Books 1 through 4 in Volume 2. Where he discusses this this tendency, the default, if you will, of equality of conditions is to lead towards democratic despotism, and in order to prevent that from happening, it requires a great deal of public vigilance to maintain liberty, and liberty, which he defines in active terms. I mean, he defines it in sort of abstract terms of individual rights and that kind of thing, but he really believes liberty is best expressed in very active terms, and through active citizenship and on a local level through mediating institutions and through the government of the township, the local government. What would you have to add to some of that?
No, I think that's great. It's just the use of larger government power by the mob to get their way. It's just exactly what you've been saying. You know, the curtailing of liberty in the name of what the people want, you know, usually through formalized institutions and usually through national formalized institutions. Although, of course, you can have tyranny of the majority at the local level as well. There's no monopoly on that in the nation as a whole.
Definitely. Yeah. And another thing that's interesting about that is that Tocqueville says that people will gladly exchange their freedom for equality. That equality is what people really, really want. And they'll exchange their freedom for it. Which, you know, like you said, you alluded to this at the beginning of our conversation, that Americans don't really think about equality and freedom or democracy as being terms that are, you know, opposed to one another. They're complementary terms. They're terms that, you know, we sort of lump all together. Equality and democracy and freedom, they all mean the same thing. But for Tocqueville, that's not the case at all. He sees them as in an opposition to one another.
Well, and I certainly think historically that he's been proven to be correct, although that's certainly a minority view.
Yeah, and I think it's a minority view. One of the reasons why I think it's a minority view is because people don't read Tocqueville.
And now we're back to democracy makes you stupid.
There you go. Exactly.
Minority view.
Yeah. I mean, the book looks good on your shelf. And the quotable Tocqueville is great for politicians to use in election time. And of course, the most famous Tocqueville line, as you know, it was not uttered by Tocqueville. America is, you know, good because she or great because she's good and so forth. So, you know, people Americans ought to be reading Tocqueville. I mean, There are great abridgments. You don't have to read the entire thing to get the spirit of and the essence of what he's saying. People need to read it. People need to read Tocqueville. Citizens need to read Tocqueville.
And a great place to start doing that is with John Wilsey's abridgment for Lexham Press. Do follow along the blog at the Acton website, which we will put a link up to in the show notes. Anything to add in conclusion?
No, I really appreciate you having this conversation with me, and hope that we can maybe have another conversation again as the blog series continues to progress.
Well, absolutely. We would love to have you back on, and I hope we can arrange that down the road. Thank you again, listeners, for joining us on the City of Man podcast. For more information about our show or any of the other shows on the network, please visit christianhumanist.org. You can also visit us on our iTunes page. Please do stop in there, leave us a rating and a review to help others find the show. You can also reach us through Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, where occasionally we will post additional articles or have small debates over various topics related to what we talk about on the show. You can also leave us messages at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. On behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.